Hello and welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast, a regular feature of the ERS Respiratory Channel. The topic of this podcast is Asthma Diagnosis in Children, Lessons Learned from the ERS Task Force. My name is Sejal Zaglani and I will be leading the discussion today. I am Professor of Paediatric Respiratory Medicine at Imperial College London and Honorary Consultant in Respiratory Paediatrics at the Royal Brompton Hospital. I also chair the Paediatric Asthma and Allergy Group within the Paediatric Assembly in ERS. My research focuses on the investigation of mechanisms underlying the onset of severe asthma and finding novel therapies to improve control and to achieve disease modification. Joining me in this discussion is Dr. Errol Gaylard. Dr. Gaylard is Associate Professor in Respiratory Sciences at the University of Leicester in the UK, and he's also Clinical Lead of the Paediatric Respiratory Service at University Hospitals in Leicester. His research interests are paediatric asthma. He's also advised the UK National Institute for Health and Care Excellence on asthma diagnosis, monitoring, and asthma quality standards. Between 2017 and 2021, Dr. Gaylard chaired a European Respiratory Society task force to develop clinical practice guidelines for the diagnosis of asthma in children. He's also a member of the British Thoracic Society Asthma Specialist Advisory Group, and he's the secretary of the ERS Paediatric Asthma and Allergy Group. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, we were not able to meet face-to-face for this discussion, but here's what we discussed about the new ERS Task Force on the Diagnosis of Asthma in Children. Welcome, Errol. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
So I guess one of the first things I wanted to ask you was, why was there a need to develop new guidelines for asthma diagnosis in children? What was the kind of reasoning behind it?
Well, as you know, and I'm really pleased to say this, that this is the first international asthma guidelines that focus entirely on asthma diagnosis, which I think is an underrepresented area. And I'm even more pleased to say that this is guidelines that focus entirely on children, and specifically in children over 5 years. I'm really absolutely delighted that the ERS has taken the decision to support this, because as you know, as paediatricians, we know that children are often somewhat sidelined when they're part of adult asthma guidelines. And the reason for this is often that there is a lot more evidence relating to adults, and there is always a danger of extrapolation. And I don't know if you'd agree with that.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. We often get lost amongst the data that's available for adult diagnosis. And I guess the main example that I can think of for that is the asthma guidelines for severe asthma, where it's kind of a joint venture and the kind of pediatric component gets lost. And there's a big focus on adolescents, but then the younger children get forgotten. So I agree that it's nice to be able to have a whole dedicated guideline for children. So in terms of these new guidelines, can you summarize the overall approach that you've taken for asthma diagnosis?
Yeah, absolutely. Before coming in the detailed description of the guideline, one of my bugbears is that guidelines are all very well, but if we want people to adopt these guidelines, you know, I feel very strongly that we need to make the case that people are enthusiastic about looking at these guidelines and wanting to make an effort to implement them. And I think the key reason for developing these guidelines and asking the ERS to support this is because we know that misdiagnosis in children is extremely common. And we have overdiagnosis, and that essentially results in children getting inappropriate medication. And the numbers from the European studies are staggering. There is misdiagnosis rates of up to 50%. And I really feel that this is unacceptable.
I agree with that. So did you have overdiagnosis in mind when you set these guidelines out, or underdiagnosis?
We really had both, because overdiagnosis is a problem where children get inappropriate medication, proper diagnosis gets missed, and of course there is always a risk of side effects. But underdiagnosis is also a major problem. And they are different topics. But, you know, Sigil, I feel very strongly that we've moved almost into an area of non-diagnosis. And it's slightly embarrassing talking from the UK, really, after UK NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Care Excellence, produced some guidelines that were very robust, evidence-based, but very clear on the need for objective tests. I think since, and paradoxically, people have been even more reluctant to diagnose asthma.
I think that's one of my worries, Errol, which is why I want you to talk me through the guidelines, because it really is about the practical implementation and how much we can convince our colleagues to do the tests that have been suggested. So maybe if you can talk us through them, and then we can have a discussion a little bit about the sort of the tests and the need for the tests.
As you know, I really strongly feel that we need to stress that we want people to diagnose children with asthma. This is not about a sitting on the fence and just a wait and see approach that we've taken for too long. So we really want people to make an effort. And so children presenting with clinical symptoms that are in keeping with an asthma diagnosis, that is cough, breathlessness, and in particular, wheeze. Wheeze is a very strong sign that asthma is a likely diagnosis, but we should not rely on clinical diagnosis. And this is where the guidelines are very clear. These children from 5 should have tests. And the tests we've chosen are those that are, you know, most widely available. And so the first line test is spirometry. And if the spirometry is abnormal, then bronchodilator reversibility. And I'm sure you'd agree that a spirometer is available in most healthcare settings. Mm-hmm. Just a reluctance to use it in children.
Yeah. And for the obstruction, airway obstruction, I just wanted to clarify, what's the ratio that's been recommended for children as being abnormal for FEV1, FVC?
We have strongly advocated, again, an ERS-supported initiative, the Global Lung Initiative, and therefore we would recommend the use of lower limits of normal. And we have stressed this. But of course, the lower limits of normal change with age, and therefore, as a child grows, the levels will change slightly. And therefore, to make it simpler for people to use the guidelines, we have agreed some cutoffs that are very close to the lower limits of normal. And therefore, any FEV1 less than 80% or an FEV1 over FVC ratio of 80% should be used to interpret this as abnormal spirometry and do additional tests.
Yeah, so people need to do their best to have the right reference ranges, but if they don't, they could use the ratio of the 80% FEV1 FVC.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. And especially for FEV1 FVC, the 80%, I think it's a slightly unusual, not unusual, but something people aren't entirely familiar with, because of course we have this adult cutoff of 70%. Yeah. And that is really highly inappropriate for children. It is much too low and does not reflect the Global Lung Initiative data.
Okay. So I guess the next question for me then is, most of the patients I see in my clinic have a normal spirometry. Usually it's plumb normal because I usually see them when they're well. So then what does the guideline suggest for those types of patients?
Yeah. As you know, that is a very difficult area and one where people have got stuck in, especially with criticism. And they're absolutely right. We need to work on this. What happens in practice at the moment is children present with symptoms and they're unfortunately not tested there and then, because that would be the right time to do it. Sure. But of course, they are then tested often in the interval. And we've shown this in a very large study in Leicestershire, studying over 600 children. And Claire Murray in Manchester has shown something very similar, and other studies. The pickup, if you test children in the interval, is maybe around 20%, give or take a few percentage. But I think where we need to move to is to test children when they're unwell.
Okay.
And I don't know if you agree, because I'm particularly frustrated that in our hospitals, you know, there is a lot of children turning up with asthma attacks. And this would be the ideal time to use tests, because you could confirm the diagnosis there and then. You can write to the GP. You can inform the families and the diagnosis is made, but we don't test these children and we send them back to the GP. And this is really a missed opportunity that I feel where we could do much, much better.
I completely agree. Even something as simple as a peak flow often isn't done when they present acutely, which would be very, very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess I was wondering about the role of exhaled nitric oxide in the algorithm. I noted that was one of the other tests that you included.
Yes, FeNO is not a test for asthma, but FeNO is a very good test to detect airway inflammation. And the task force realizes that FeNO isn't widely available because it's not cheap. There are equipment costs and then there are costs to running the test. And in many parts of Europe, this is not available. But there have been recent studies adding to a body of evidence from previous studies that show that FeNO really is a good test to support a diagnosis of asthma. And many studies that have emerged over the last few years with very large numbers have supported that notion. The danger, of course, with FeNO is that children with allergic rhinitis sometimes have raised FeNO. And this is something that needs to be borne in mind. But this is, I think, where the spirometry helps. We would strongly support the use.
Would you suggest that for the asthma diagnosis, the FeNO should be measured off treatment, off inhaled steroids? Because obviously inhaled steroids might affect the result as well. Is that incorporated in the algorithm?
That would probably have been slightly too complicated, but you're okay. Absolutely right. There isn't really a quick fix for many problems that we have, and especially the one where children are already on treatment.
Okay.
But I'm sure you're very familiar with the GINA, and they've made some recommendations that I think are worthwhile, but we haven't referred to them specifically in these guidelines. I think what needs to happen with the FeNO, first of all, it's often raised even in children on treatment. And this could be that either the treatment isn't suppressing the asthma fully or that families and children are not super compliant with their treatment. But what I would say is if there is any diagnostic doubt, then probably clinicians need to be confident to step down with the preventer treatment, the inhaled corticosteroids, and over time, a picture would then emerge.
Great. So one question I guess I have, because these are tests for children, and sometimes some of our younger patients just can't do the tests, which is, you know, this, what would you suggest for those patients?
Again, you will have noticed, like we all have, that there sometimes is a reluctance to test children. And what is stated is, they can't do it because they're too young. And good studies have shown, including our study in Leicestershire, that this is not true. Of the 600 plus children, well over 95% managed the test. What is particularly important is that 95% of five-year-olds managed to do spirometry at the first attempt in a practice, even though they'd never encountered this test. So I think with a bit of training, the success is very high. FeNO, of course, as you know, is a slightly different challenge. Somehow the breathing maneuver is felt to be more difficult in younger children, and probably with current technology that I think could be improved on, we could do better. But from 8 years, virtually every child managed to get a FeNO reading. Now, back to your question, is that I feel, okay, there will be children that will not manage the test.
Yeah, and I guess I'm thinking more about, you know, the clinical, practical clinical setting as opposed to a study setting. You know, it might be a bit different.
Indeed, you're absolutely right. The real world data is always a little bit different to the research world data. But what I would say is that clinicians should continue to pursue the diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And the way to do it, you may find that you can't diagnose the child there and then, and the doctor may have to treat empirically at this point. Mm-hmm. But we shouldn't give up at this point. We should invite the child back and we should continue to test until we've nailed the diagnosis.
Fair enough. And I guess maybe this is perhaps a difficult question, but what if genuinely the tests aren't available to a clinician? Should they refer on, or should they, what should they do?
The task force was hoping that the report or the guidelines would provide ammunition for clinicians that haven't got access to the equipment and tests to lobby their decision makers and their healthcare services to provide the tests. If it's really not possible, then we would really encourage clinicians to refer children to specialist settings where the tests are available for them to make a diagnosis and report back to them.
Fair enough, yeah. So I guess then that's the million-dollar question, Errol. As you've said, and when we started, that the evidence in children can be quite sparse. So having done the task force and looked at the evidence, what are your kind of top three unmet needs in terms of the research that we need to really get an optimal algorithm for asthma diagnosis in children?
Well, I feel first and foremost in this case, what we need is implementation studies.
Okay.
And, you know, clinicians, we're all excited about randomized controlled trials. We want to try new therapies, maybe new diagnostic tests, and try them out in randomized controlled trials to see which group does better. And that's probably the most common clinical study undertaken, probably in adults and children. But I don't know if you'd agree, implementation studies are scarce, and we don't do enough of them. Just finding that something is useful doesn't mean it's going to get implemented in practice. And we've seen that with the UK NICE asthma guidelines. And so to me, an implementation study would be really important. After that, I think nobody has ever really tested the diagnostic algorithm that we're proposing. And I think that would be really important also to make a health economic evaluation. And that will allow us to reassess the proposals. You will be aware that the tests themselves are robust in their setting, but the sequence of tests and an algorithm and the success rate once you've run through the algorithm, that is much less clear.
Sure. Were there any obvious gaps or other tests that just haven't been looked at in children that you think would be helpful for future work?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I would have put as the third area that we need to explore. We need to have better tests. And I say this with some trepidation because I think spirometry is an excellent test and maybe the only test that will give us a really global picture of lung health in combination with inflammation. But once that's established, there is a lot of interest in technology such as forced oscillation, where there is no active participation required from the patient, no active maneuver, and measures the airway dynamics. And in fact, we're doing a study ourselves at the moment, and I know many other people are interested in this technology because it's fairly quick and as I say, would not require any effort. But it's not the only one. There is other technologies appearing, wearable technologies that could provide a picture of the child's respiratory condition and support asthma diagnosis. And finally, of course, there is a lot of interest in breath technology, because again, it would be non-invasive, it would be repeatable. And that's another area that's generated quite a lot of interest.
Okay, so that's there with kind of all of the things that I wanted to discuss. Is there anything we haven't mentioned that you wanted to highlight from the guideline? I'm sure it was a huge amount of work.
It was a very good effort, but I have to say there was a lot of very enthusiastic and dedicated people who contributed to these guidelines. So it's not been as difficult as maybe it could have been. I think really the message from the task force is that we really very strongly feel that asthma in children needs to be taken seriously, and we should stop belittling the condition and expect that children will grow out of it. I think this is very damaging to children, young people and families. It leads to a lot of problems like the epidemic of asthma attacks. Mm-hmm. We see in the UK more deaths than in many other places. And I think it's really important that we allow children to have the same importance as adults with asthma. And I think that to me is really important. And the diagnosis is absolutely the first step to take this condition more seriously.
Definitely. Great. Thanks very much, Errol. I really enjoyed talking to you today. Great.
Yeah, really a pleasure too. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you for joining us for this ERS podcast. I have enjoyed taking part, and thank you to Dr. Errol Gaylard for his contributions and insights on this topic. You can visit the ERS Respiratory Channel each month for more podcasts featuring discussion between experts on the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine.